Please turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. We introduced or taught in Ecclesiastes chapter 7 this past Sunday evening, which is our first time to look at a passage from this book on a Sunday evening, but it fit well with what kind of the timing of everything last week and Sunday night. So we're back into our Wednesday night version of Ecclesiastes, picking up with verses 15 and following in chapter 7. As you know, verses 1 to 14 was Solomon's introduction of the subject of wisdom into the book here of his journal, making the clear point that we definitely need wisdom, but not just any wisdom, not some sort of human wisdom. It's exalting the virtues of God's wisdom, wisdom from Him, or what Solomon might even call above the sun wisdom. You know that phrase I've mentioned many times to you. In this book, living life under the sun, the horizontal life, the earthly life, the human life. But there's a wisdom that's associated with that, but there's a wisdom that's above the sun, God's wisdom. And God's wisdom is something that equips us. It helps us to see life the way we ought to. It helps us to handle life the way it really, really is. Here's one possible definition of wisdom, and there's more than one right way probably to term it. But wisdom can be thought of this way. It's the God-given ability to see life with objectivity, to see life in an objective way, and then to handle life with stability in a stable way. So wisdom is the God-given ability. It's above the sun wisdom that we're talking about, to see life with objectivity, to view it rightly, correctly, objectively. And then to handle life in a certain way, to live life with stability, to handle life with stability. When we operate in the sphere of the wisdom of God, when we live life according to that, when it's at work in our minds and in our lives, we look at life through lenses of objective perception. And we respond to it then with a certain kind of calm confidence because we have this above-the-sun wisdom. And when that's true, there's going to be this remarkable absence of fear in our lives. We're not going to live our lives any given moment seized with panic. Why? Because we have this objectivity through which we're seeing everything. That's a godly perspective. And then we're choosing then to respond to the things or handle life in a stable way because of the wisdom we have. So it doesn't really matter what happens. And things do happen. There's no way to deny that. There's things that people deal with all the time at work. Losing your job or being promoted at your job. I mean, either one could happen. Those are happening all the time in various people's lives. Well, when you have God's wisdom, ultimately, though there's human disappointment and human concern and all that, ultimately, we can either lose our job or we can be promoted at work. Neither one's going to derail us, is the idea. Neither one is going to cause us to crash, you know, in life. Because we're seeing everything with this God-given objectivity. And we're handling it then with stability, with His wisdom. So I'm just saying there is this sense of objectivity and stability that wisdom brings us to our life. So that we're not living life in some sort of dreamland fantasy. No, we're dealing with reality. We see life realistically. This wisdom is not something then you can learn in a classroom. This kind of wisdom is not something on paper. You can't just lecture on it and you take notes and then people, okay, now I got it. No, it's not something academic. It's not even something theoretical. It is something very, very practical from God that ends up working in a practical way in our lives, affecting the way we live. That's the way God intended this wisdom to be. It's above the sun wisdom, but He intended it for it to operate under the sun. Now He begins this section of His journal, verses 15, chapter 7, by saying, I've seen it all. Verse 15, I have seen everything during my lifetime of futility. It's not a bragging statement. It's not his intent. He's just being honest with all the research that he's done, with all the things he's experienced, with all the study he's put into this. He basically is just saying, I'm telling you, I've seen everything. I've seen it all. And having seen it all, this king has come to realize then the value of wisdom. And that's what he's been telling us in chapter 7. Now, verses 15 and following, we're going to see some facts now about wisdom that will help us understand just what a great benefit it is to us. It'll help us understand and to see how wisdom works its way practically in our lives. What is the effect practically it's supposed to have? Let me read verses 15 to 18. The first fact is this: wisdom brings balance. It brings balance. Verses 15 and 18. I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There's a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous, and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp one thing and also not let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Like a lot of passages in this book, you can't just take a superficial run at the wording of it and really understand Solomon's intent here. So let's pick this apart a bit. First fact is wisdom brings balance. Now, if you're not careful, this passage seems to say, for example, in the verse 15, that the righteous suffer unfairly and the wicked don't suffer. It even appears to be saying that we shouldn't be then too righteous. You can get to a point where you're living too righteous a life, and that's not good. It even seems to be saying that in verse 17, that even a little wickedness might be a good thing as well. He says, don't be excessively wicked. That's all. Well, we're not just going to leave it at that and go on. Is that what he means? Is that what he's saying? We obviously need to understand the intent of the verse. I'll give you an example in Scripture somewhere else where you've got to obviously deal with the intent. And I think once we see the wording of it, we'll know in this verse that we'll turn to. In fact, you can do it. Deuteronomy 27, verse 24. Let's turn to that real quickly. This is sort of a teaching exercise here on interpretation. Deuteronomy 27, verse 24. And being careful about clinging to conclusions that the author does not intend. Deuteronomy 27, 24. And this is in a whole series of cursings. Cursed is he who strikes his neighbor in secret. Now, can we all agree that verse is most likely not teaching that public murder is okay? It's just private murder that we're concerned about in the Bible? After all, he says, you're cursed if you do it in secret. So if you do it publicly, we're talking about homicide here. If you do it publicly, then it's okay, right? Well, I think we know enough about Scripture to say, no, there's got to be more to it than that. The Bible can't be saying that, and that's true. I'm just kind of using that as an illustration here, that you always have to go back to the intent of what the author means, the authorial intent. And we have a case of that here in Ecclesiastes. When you take a statement like, do not be excessively wicked. Well, is that like that Deuteronomy statement? You can just don't kill privately in secret, but do it publicly. Is he saying don't be excessively wicked? In other words, then be a little bit wicked? Well, first of all, verses 16 and 17, start with those on the subject of righteousness. He's not cautioning when he says, do not be excessively righteous. He's not talking about real righteousness, okay? Real holiness, genuine and sincere righteousness. What's discouraged is not excessive righteousness of that kind. He has a particular kind of righteousness in his mind here. It is what he's observed in many, many people, something we would call self-righteousness. It's self-righteousness. Do not be excessively righteous has to be taken ironically here, referring to the way a person thinks about himself and how he thinks he presents himself. He has determined himself that he is righteous. So it's this idea of being greatly righteous or excessively righteous, not literally referring don't have too much righteousness. And here's the danger he's warning about. The danger that people can delude themselves, can deceive themselves and others, actually, through all kinds of pseudo-religious acts, all kinds of acts of sanctimoniousness, we might call them, ostentatious showmanship of worship, you know, religious things that they do, some sort of condescending, holier-than-thou attitude that's like a veneer on somebody. He's talking about an insincere veneer, self-righteousness. It can even be those who are in the throes and the grass of legalism, who are very hyperly critical against any kind of deviations that are out there, and they pride themselves that they don't deviate them, but deviations from their own sort of Christian cultural norms. And they equate those things, those traditions, to God's righteousness. So they pride themselves in that kind of excessive righteousness to the max. We obey the rules. We obey the laws. To the max, we have this show of, this ostentatious show of religious acts. To the max, there is this multiplicity of pseudo-religious sanctimoniousness. The real clue then to this passage is the second verb in verse 16. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. That's a Hebrew word that is to be interpreted what we call reflexively, saying something about yourself. You could translate it this way: don't play the wise man. Don't fall in this trap of playing or faking being wise, being righteous. It's play-acting righteousness. It delights in sort of a reputation of wisdom, but wisdom's not really there in the person's life. There's a companion thought that Solomon, same writer, put in Proverbs chapter 3. Look at that with me. Proverbs 3, verse 7. Proverbs 3, verse 7. Here's the concept. And he states it clearly here. Do not be wise in your own eyes. This was a concern of Solomon, because this is what he observes in people. This self-righteousness, this holier-than-thou veneer, this legalistic sort of trap of obeying all the cultural religious norms and priding yourself on them and coming to the conclusion that all this wisdom you have about, you talk about here, Solomon, oh, I have that. No, he's warns us in more than one place. Not only Ecclesiastes here, but Proverbs. Don't be wise in your own eyes. That's the meaning of this term in verse 16, of not being greatly or overly wise. So here he's painting the picture then of this pious person, but it's not genuine piety. It's a super pious person, this overly zealous individual who is really consumed with this need to impress other people with his righteousness. He's a fanatic. You could even translate the intent here. Don't be a fanatic. If you're talking about fanaticism being this self-made sort of stuff that you're doing, that's not sincere. That's fanaticism. This person is a master of external impressions. That's what he cares about. And he's self-sufficient. So there's an implied lesson here to us. It's a good idea periodically then to check ourselves, to look at our looks, you know. It's all too easy to become foolishly fanatical and get out of balance in our Christianity and then pride ourselves on our self-made righteousness and thinking we're wise in our own eyes. Solomon's just making it clear, when I'm talking about wisdom, I'm not talking about that. That's not the kind of wisdom that's going to help you live life. That's not the kind of wisdom that's above the sun wisdom. It's really helpful to realize that discerning people out there are not very impressed with our overwise or our super spiritual lifestyle that we pride ourselves on. As opposed to this, if it's genuine, if it's true, if it's authentic, if you have the right stuff, so to speak, you don't have to say a word. You don't have to flaunt it. You don't have to be a fanatic to get your point across that you love Christ and you love holiness and you want to live a pure life, and you want to please the Lord, and there's a God consciousness and a fear of God in your life, you don't have to push that on people to get the point across. That's fanaticism. That's excessive righteousness. That's being overly wise in your own eyes. That's not the religion of the Bible to live that way. Verse 17, though, is another danger. There's a danger of self-righteousness, but there's a contrary danger, and that's actually surrendering to evil. Now, he's saying here, do not be excessively wicked. He's not by that meaning, then, like I said, a little wickedness is okay. Wickedness in moderation is acceptable. He's recognizing here wickedness as a fact of life. We don't have that same Hebrew kind of expression, do not be overly wise, which is play-acting wisdom. Here he's just coming straight to the point. There's another danger that you've got to be careful about. And that is saying, okay, you're right. I don't want to be concerned about living by rules and regulations. I don't want a fake Christianity. I don't want a fanatical kind of life. That's not effective. People run from that. You don't influence anybody with that. You go easily to the other extreme, and that is falling the trap where wickedness is a pattern of life. So Solomon recognizes that wickedness is a fact of human experience. And Solomon's ultimate point then with these two verses is this idea of balance in your life. A wise person is balanced. The right life walks the path between these two extremes, shunning self-righteousness and deluding ourselves into thinking that rules and regulations and cultural, biblical, or religious norms is true Christianity. We shun that, but neither do we become a libertine, and just allow our freedom and our sort of inborn wickedness just run its course. No, we have to say no to sin. We have to be concerned about holiness, not self-righteousness, but genuine righteousness. And so then he concludes this idea of balance then with verse 18. And this is all kind of compatible then with what he says in verse 18. It's good that you grasp the one and not let go of the other. The one and the other is referring back to these two extremes. So we have this warning here in 16 and following, and now this conclusion in verse 18. You may have a translation that says the word all in there. It's good that you grasp one thing and not to let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with all of them. If you have a translation, use the word all there at the end. It's a Hebrew word that is used. It's translated all, but it's only used when you're talking about two things. So all of them, both. Okay, it's an all that refers to two things. And so you can translate it then, therefore, both. And so many of the translations do. It's both. You need to have something about both in your life, which ends up saying what you're doing is you're walking this line of balance down the middle. Balance is a virtue in Scripture. And it's true about so many things. Obviously, what he's saying here, that we can't just say no to righteousness because there's a fanaticism that's not pleasing to God. We've got to be very careful that we don't fall off on that side of the road or fall off on this side of the road. That we're balanced. I mean, think how many things that we have to apply that to in our Christian life, to walk this thin line, and how much wisdom it takes to live a life that's balanced so that you don't go to either extreme on anything. There are extremes in doctrine that we have to be careful about, that we so affirm the sovereignty of God that we're ignoring scriptures that talk about the responsibility of man, or that we're so focus on the responsibility of man that is to the sacrifice of the verses that talk about the sovereignty of God. There is this knife edge, in a sense. We are to seek to walk in life on so many subjects. I mean, we're to really, really just love the Lord, focus on the Lord, be captured by Him. To the detriment of living in the real world and caring about humans and checking out of reality and losing touch with humanity? No. Are we to be so earthly and so in touch with humans and so in tune with the human life and so focused on the issues of what it means to be human in this world and social reform and things like that, that we've lost sight of, well, the greater priority is that we be completely captured by Christ? No. Which is it? Yes. We have to have both. There's a balance there. We exalt the Word of God and we talk about it all the time. It's sufficient. It's authoritative. It's inerrant. It's inspired. But there actually is an extreme there, a fanaticism in a sense, if you want to call it that, that some have termed bibliolatry, where we worship the print on the page as opposed to the truth that it represents and whom it's from. There's a balance there. We're to be zealous toward the lost. The Bible presents that as an aggressiveness on our part, you know, compelling people to come in. What's the balance? Well, in a sense, giving non-Christians a break, you know, and loving them with a little wisdom and tact and graciousness and having understanding and having heart and understanding where they are. It's both, see. So many issues you could just keep going on. And so what Solomon is doing is just kind of giving a good example of it, of what he's observed. I've seen it all. I certainly have seen this, that there are these people who are the righteous who perish in their righteousness. But you know what he's saying is? It's not real righteousness. It's not that. Everybody who claims to be righteous is not really righteous. There's a lot. It's self-righteousness. It's fake. It's veneer. Wisdom from above, God's wisdom, helps you walk this line in the middle. And so verse 18 says, it's good that you grasp one thing, not let go of the other. How do you do that? The one who fears God comes forth with both of them. He's balanced. And that's wisdom. We know in Proverbs, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and wisdom. This righteous person who sees clearly in life and is fleshing out this practical wisdom in his life, walking between extremes. What motivates him? What gives him this wisdom? It's the reverence for God in his life. That reverence for God, that high view of God, has helped him have a particular kind of above-the-sun wisdom that keeps him balanced in life. People that are at extremes really have not grasped hold of wisdom from God. They're not seasoned. They're erratic. They're impulsive. They're not balanced. There's another fact about wisdom. Not only does it bring balance, but second, wisdom produces strength. It produces strength. In verses 19 to 22. Wisdom strengthens a wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on earth who continually does good and who never sins. Also, do not take seriously all the words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For you also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. Now, again, particular style of writing, proverbial kind of approach to writing. So you have to dig in to find out, okay, what's his point? Well, his point is in these verses that wisdom produces strength. And like I said, wisdom is this objectivity to life. It produces this stability in life. So this is fleshing that out. Wisdom is helping you be balanced. You won't get off into extremes when you have God's wisdom. And you'll have strength to deal, inner strength, to deal with what happens in life. Now he says the one who has this wisdom, in verse 19, has this inner strength that you could not even get if you were to go before a city council, he says, you know, 10 rulers in the city, sort of go before the city council, get their wisdom, their advice on things. There is a wisdom, an inner strength that's greater than that, is his point. You have wisdom from God. It is an inner strength that is far more valuable to you than all the advice that you might give from a city council full of advisors, is the idea. But it's inner strength for what? I think we'll see. He's given examples of it. He's talking about the painful tensions that exist in our world. The things about our life that are hard. There are things about earthly existence under the sun that are painful. There are inequities. Our lives are full of questions. We live with a lot of tensions, things that we have to accept that we don't understand. And many, many people struggle with life because it's that way. That's reality, and they don't like it. People who are wise are stable. They go through all the inequities of life, the problems in this world. They're not into extremes, and neither are they thrown off track or derailed because of the unfairness kinds of things in this world or the problems that exist in this world. A person who must have everything a certain way, and when they're not, and they're frustrated, what do we call them? A person who has to have everything perfect, we say they are a perfectionist. He's actually talking about the absolute idiocy of trying to be a perfectionist in this kind of world. Okay? You'll be miserable and frustrated all the time. Wisdom helps you be different than that. It gives you a strength where you can deal with all those kind of things in life that don't work out. A perfectionist is not a good thing. We label ourselves that way. But don't do that and then take pride in it. You know, I'm just a perfectionist. That's not a good thing. It's something to get over. Okay? And it's not the same thing as trying to pursue excellence in your life. Perfectionism is something different. I like one quote I found about perfectionism. One man said this, quote, "God bless you if you're a perfectionist, and God help you. But God especially help those who live with you." Okay? Because they've got it the hardest. Okay. You're frustrated and irritated because life is not fair, it doesn't work out, and it's a problem for everybody around you. Here's a humorous definition of a perfectionist. And you got to see the dot, dot, dot. It's sort of an ellipsis here where the thought's not finished. He says, "A perfectionist is one who takes great pains and gives them to others." Takes great pain in everything. But he gives all that great pain to everybody around him. You see, perfectionists want everything to fit in this nice little box, an exact 4x4 square in life. Everything must either be black or it must be white. The grays of life will drive a perfectionist crazy. But Paul didn't write this. Solomon did. Paul wrote nothing in the Old Testament at all. Solomon is saying the more we glean God's wisdom, the more strength, this inner strength that we're going to have then to live with the questions and the tensions and the imperfections of this life. And God's wisdom is greater than the advice you'd get from this council of advisors. Okay. Now, how does God give us this wisdom, how to live? He does not give us rules and regulations for every single thing that happens. Every single moment of your life, He doesn't give you one of those. What He does in His Word is give you some overall guidelines and principles, and then He allows us to make decisions in life according to those things. And then by doing that on a daily basis, we learn how to walk then through life with Him. It's almost like wisdom ends up being this sixth sense that we need in life. And it's something that matures us so that even if we have unanswered questions, even if there are inequities, even if there are tensions, we press on in spite of all those things. I'm still learning a lot in my life, but I definitely have learned this as best I can, especially in the last 10 or so years of my life. I have definitely learned the older I get, I do not have all the answers. Okay? And the older you've gotten, I would trust you've learned the same thing. I don't have all the answers. When I graduated from college, I did. I had all the answers. I lost a little bit of it, but then I went to seminary. So when I graduated from seminary, I had all the answers once again. But I've learned I don't. But I've learned something else too. In many, many cases, it doesn't matter. It ultimately doesn't matter. But it takes great strength to be able to live that way, to handle the the painful tensions of life, to handle the unanswered questions in life. And so what wisdom ends up being is this mental cushion that's like a buffer that handles all these blows that come to you in life so that you can deal with it, you can go on, so you don't have to have everything black and white. Things can stay gray. You don't have to have all the blanks filled in your life. You don't have to sweep clean every single theological corner, every single verse of the Bible. Now, verse 20, then he sort of gives you one very big problem in this world that we do all have to live with. It's the reason there are all these inequities. It's the reason that there's all these tensions. The reason things don't always work out. Why? The earth is full of what? Sinners. It's chock full of sinners. Indeed, there is not a righteous man on the earth who continually does good and who never sins. Just so you'll know, these are similar to his words elsewhere. Listen to 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 46. Just listen to it. 1 Kings 8, 46. He's writing, when they sin against you, sort of a parenthesis, for there is no one who does not sin, and you're angry with them and deliver them to an enemy so they'll be taken away captive to the land of the enemy. He goes on then. He's making the point. When this happens, when they sin against you, parentheses, for there is no man who does not sin. He's very conscious of this. And he's observed it again in his life. And he's pointing out there is no righteous man on the earth. And it's emphatic here. That word indeed at the very beginning is an emphatic statement. You could translate it surely. With that introduction, he's saying this is a universal truth. There is no one who does not sin, who's not a sinner, and it includes both kinds of sins in that statement, sins of commission and sins of omission. Notice how he says it there. There is not a righteous man on the earth who continually does good. Okay? That's half of it. And stated the other way, who never sins. So there's this positive righteousness, and then there's the negative who doesn't sin. He always does good, and he never sins. No. He's included sins of commission here, sins of omission here. If you wrap it all up, there is no one who does good and no one who never sins. And that's at the root of our problems in this under-the-sun existence. So there isn't anyone who doesn't sin. Every single person has the ability, any given moment, to frustrate your life. They can frustrate you. They can disillusion you. Any given moment, someone can hurt you. Any given moment, someone can foul up your plans and your dreams. This is the real world. This is reality. It is not perfect. We don't live in a sterile environment. Using medical terms, you know, we're not doing sterile surgery. We're operating in a dirty operating room. We're living life, you and I. But wisdom gives us the ability to deal with this lack of sterility in life. It gives us breathing space. It gives us thinking space. It helps us go on. It gives us the strength to deal with the painful tensions of life. And he goes on. There's a strength that helps us avoid something else. It helps us deal with the painful things of life because of this reality that everyone's a sinner. Things are frustrated. Verse 21, also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken, lest you hear your servant cursing you. What does he mean by that? That proverb, proverbial statement. He's talking about the strength that wisdom gives you to help you avoid being either gullible in life or intimidated in life by others. See, that's describing a life that's stable in this world. You go through life without this sense of intimidation or gullibility. Now, there's more than one kind of statement made to us that we have to be careful with in life when people say something to us. On one end, there's this gullibility we have to be careful about. Do not take seriously all the words which are spoken. Okay? And then he gives you an example. But that's a general statement first. Don't take seriously all the words that are spoken to you. What kind of words are spoken to you? Well, two kinds, good and bad. there's the good kind. There's praise. So Solomon says a wise person is going to go through life being very careful when admirers offer praise. Wisdom is something from God that's like a filtering system that helps keep you from believing everything you hear when you're being praised. And that keeps you in touch with reality. If it wasn't for that, if it wasn't for God's wisdom, you can hear enough of that and you can just sort of float away into a fantasy world thinking how great you are. God's wisdom won't allow that. It helps you not believe everything you hear. But there's another kind of word that's spoken that you can't take seriously. And he gives you an example of that one. Lest you hear your servant cursing you. That's at the other end. That's criticism. Criticism is a reality of life too. There are people, though I haven't found it in 1 Corinthians or Romans or Ephesians when it talks about the spiritual gifts, there are people who believe their spiritual gift is the gift of criticism. And they're amazing, really. I mean, they can tell you something wrong all the time, three things a day with your life that's wrong. And they'll carry out the faithful exercise of this gift by mail, phone, email, face-to-face. If they can't do it directly, they'll do it indirectly. I mean, we live in a world like that where criticism is going to happen. And so wisdom gives you the strength to resist it and then not be intimidated by it. So on one hand, wisdom helps you not be gullible, to believe everything you hear. Wisdom helps you resist criticism and not to be intimidated by it so that you handled it well. And he mentions a servant here in his example. Basically, that's representing somebody who knows you well, somebody you regularly interact with. It could be someone you work with. It could be a close friend. It could be a former boss. You can broaden the intent here to capture what he means. And the point is, don't be intimidated. And some people live their lives intimidated because of criticism. Any little statement made by somebody can alter them to go a different direction, or can send them spiraling down if it's negative, can send them home thinking about how their world has just collapsed because somebody didn't like me. Somebody said something negative. I think one of the reasons that we are so intimidated by criticism when someone else says something negative about us is because privately we know our faults. In other words, we're each our own worst critic in most cases. We criticize ourselves privately. So when someone else does it as well, they're affirming what we've already said about ourselves, that we didn't think we were so great anyway. And it makes us feel even worse. So we have to learn to deal with criticism in life. Interesting that the Bible, through Solomon, wants to encourage us in this regard, to handle criticism. Sometimes you just have to consider the source. There are those people who are just critical. They live to find things that are wrong. But if it's valid criticism, we should want to hear it. If it's constructive, if it's from a person who knows you well and wants to help you and loves you too much to continue allowing you to go down a wrong path, we're wise to hear the reproofs of the wise, and we're wise to reject the unconstructive criticism and not be intimidated by those who aren't doing it lovingly. Wisdom helps you deal with both kinds. We should care a lot about listening to a person who loves us and who's wise, and we should care nothing about listening to them, to everybody else, and living our lives controlled by people. People try to hold others hostage with their criticism. This is very practical for church leaders. I couldn't help but think of this as I was studying this. We cannot allow ourselves to be controlled by criticism. Both sides are true. You know, don't take seriously everything that's said about you that's praised, and don't be intimidated by all the criticism or fault-finding. We can't allow ourselves to be derailed from what we believe is right to do in our lives and in the church because one person questions something or criticizes something. That's fear of man. That's being controlled. If someone truly loves us and loves the church, we must humbly hear their perspective. If they do truly love us and the church, they'll go to great pains to see that their criticism is well-timed and it's gracious and it's constructive. J. Oswald Sanders said this about in his book, great book, Spiritual Leadership. Listen carefully. What leader or preacher does not desire to be popular with his constituency? Certainly, there is no virtue in unpopularity. Interesting statement. It's not virtuous to be unpopular. And I've actually known some preachers who thought it was. That if they've been very, very caustic with all their things that they do and pounding the pulpit, and like one pastor told me, he says, my job is just to skin people alive. I get tired of being there after a while, you know. I served on staff with that one. It was not in California, okay? It was not him. Certainly, there's no virtue in unpopularity, but popularity can be purchased at too high a price. Jesus made this crystal clear when he said, "Woe unto you when all men speak well of you." And he expressed the complementary truth when he said, "Blessed are ye when men revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake." Great wisdom from J. Oswald Sanders there in the book Spiritual Leadership. We're all familiar with Spurgeon, obviously a famous British preacher. When he was still in his 20s, there were hundreds of people that would line up outside the church, waiting in the snow for the doors to open at Metropolitan Tabernacle just to get in so they could possibly hear this man preach. They couldn't even at that day build a building big enough to house all the people who wanted to hear Spurgeon preach. Before he even reached middle age, he was highly visible. And once you're highly visible and that popular, you're also going to be highly criticized. So he wrote this in a book. You find this quote in a book called Encounter with Spurgeon. It's actually written by a man named Helmut Thielecki. But there's a quote from Spurgeon in the book. Spurgeon says, "Success exposes a man to the pressure of people and thus tempts him to hold on to his gains by means of fleshly methods and practices, and to let himself be ruled wholly by the dictatorial demands of incessant expansion. Success can go to my head and will unless I remember that it is God who accomplishes the work, that he can continue to do so without my help, and that he will be able to make out with other means whenever he cuts me down to size." Basically just saying in a poetic fashion, God doesn't need me. He can speak through somebody else. And as soon as he cuts one person down to size or that person leaves the scene or whatever, he'll use somebody else. I guess Solomon is just trying to say, and we have to examine our habits when it comes to responding to criticism. Then, do we take seriously all the words that are spoken? Are we gullible? Are we intimidated at the other extreme by criticism? And there's something else that can help you in the moment of criticism, not be intimidated, to humbly be receptive to those, on the other hand, that want to help. Just remember this. The truth of the matter is, if somebody criticizes you, you know worse things about yourself than that person knows. Okay? Just be glad they don't know those. Okay? And just be glad that they're criticizing you on the thing they're criticizing you. Because if they could read your mind and see your heart, they would have more fodder. And remember that if the cursing servant, in this example, did know how bad you really are, they would certainly say worse. So we can be thankful that they're just hitting the visible. Verse 22, we'll end. Just a little reminder to humble us. You also have realized that you likewise have many times cursed others. Just remember that we've done the same thing to others, and that's a little bit humbling to know. Wisdom helps us then rise above receiving false criticism and exposes the pride in our lives if we let wisdom do that. And verse 22 is God's way of then of doing that through his wisdom to humble us. And this wisdom, like I said, is found only in God. It's a wisdom that is not earthly. It's not something that is in you. It's from God, and it helps you have this ability to see life objectively so that you're handling life then with stability. It brings you this much needed balance in this world of extremes on almost every subject. You're balanced. It gives strength in a world that is filled with weakness and uncertainty and gray things all around us. It gives you strength to accept that and not to be derailed. Wisdom then ends up being very, very practical in our life. We're going to see one more in our next time together.